We are back in session. Today is Thursday, February 15th, 2024. We have four cases in our oral calendar today. This is the third of the four. This is A23-1127, In re the Estate of Roger Abrahamson. Counsel for appellants, you will have 15 minutes for your initial arguments. And then, let's make sure I have this right here, for respondents, plural. It's my understanding that counsel for respondent Homeward Bound will have 5 minutes. Okay.
Yes, thank you, counsel.
And then 10 minutes for respondent Union Gospel Mission Twin Cities. We'll have 10 minutes. Is that correct?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Perfect. And then after your 15 minutes total, then appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you so choose. When the parties approach the podium, please state your name for the record and the party you are representing. This is being recorded, and that recording will be available within the next day or two. The podium can be raised or lowered. There's a button underneath, so you can adjust it. You can also adjust the microphone. Please do so to make sure that we can hear you clearly when you are making your arguments. And with that, counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. My name is Joseph Cantor, K-A-N-T-O-R. I'm appearing on behalf of Michelle Stark, who was the petitioner for intestacy in the district court. There's been a lot of activity in this file over the last 3 years. The case boils down to, how is a will executed in Minnesota? What's evidentiary level necessary to prove that will at summary judgment and at trial, and whose burden it is to prove those items. We had a summary judgment motion, we had a trial, and at the end of the trial, the judge issued a very lengthy order which probated the will. Finding of fact 18 sums up the lack of evidence and the issues very nicely. The identity of the second witness to the will is unknown. The signature is illegible. It is dated December 4th, 2013, which is the day after Clausen and Abrahamson signed the will. Union Gospel Mission admitted did not investigate the identity of the second witness. The record created during the evidentiary hearing is completely silent as to the potential identity of the second witness, as UGM failed to introduce any evidence pertaining to the identity of the second witness of the will. No witness at the evidentiary hearing was present when the purported second witness signed the document. No witness testified as to the identity of the purported second witness. The court did not receive any testimony regarding when the markings were made or other factual circumstances surrounding the second signature. No evidence was received by the court as to whether or not any purported second witness was competent to witness the will. And finally, there's no evidence beyond the signature itself indicating that Abrahamson properly executed the will in front of a second witness by acknowledging his signature in front of this unknown second witness. This was pointed out at summary judgment, and the court at that stage said, nope, the issue of whether or not a will was validly executed is a question of fact for trial. This was error. This was error because the non-moving party has the burden of putting factual issues into dispute. If you look at the record at summary judgment stage, no affidavits, no evidence was received that says it was validly, the will was validly executed.
Well, counsel, if I could stop you there.
Yes.
Are you arguing the summary judgment motion, that the summary judgment motion was improperly granted?
Improperly denied.
Or, I'm sorry, improperly denied, thank you.
Yes, improperly
okay.
denied, yes.
Is that issue even properly before us? Because the case ultimately went to trial, and that issue has been resolved.
That issue, well, that's why we're here on appeal, Your Honor. We don't believe it was resolved correctly. But no, we don't believe that Bayer or the scope of review issues that were raised in the briefs bar review at this stage.
Well, but a denial summary judgment that's based on disputed material facts does not, if it doesn't affect the judgment after the trial on the merits, then that issue, we don't review whether the district court erred or not in granting summary judgment.
But
and that's what occurred here.
Except it wasn't just based on an issue of fact, it was also on a mistake of law. The issue is that the court improperly held that it was that the proponent of the will doesn't have any burden to come forward with affirmative facts to put something into.
That's a separate issue and
okay,
from summary judgment. Whether or not there's an error of law that the district court made, that's a separate issue as to whether or not the district court erred in terms of granting summary judgment. I'm not sure that issue of summary judgment is even properly before us at this stage.
Okay. Well, I would disagree. I think I outlined it in the brief, and I believe the denial is reviewable under these facts and this law.
Isn't the basic rule under Rule of Civil Appellate Procedure 103.04 that we can review any order affecting the order from which the appeal is taken, and on appeal from a judgment may review an order involving the merits or affecting the judgment? So how does the order denying summary judgment affect the judgment admitting the will to probate?
I believe it affected it by narrowing the issues and saying these are the contested facts for trial, and didn't outline the actual fact that was at issue. There were three facts that the district court judge used to deny summary judgment, and those three facts I don't believe included the ultimate issue about the second witness. It said whether or not the document was a three-page document or a two-page document in a codicil, whether or not it was validly executed, and if you give me a moment, I will find it what the third one was. But I don't believe that those were the issues that were decided at trial.
I think one of the issues that the district court identified is whether there was a competent second witness.
Yes, that's correct, Your Honor. The competency of the second witness did come up at trial, but the issue that was not addressed was whether or not there was a second witness.
Well, I think inherent in that is whether there was, in fact, a second witness in the first instance. I mean, if there's no witness, then it doesn't matter whether they're competent or not.
Exactly. That's very true, Your Honor. And that's kind of my point through the entire proceeding, Your Honor, is that there's no evidence of a second witness.
Other than the signature.
The signature. And nobody has come forward with any evidence that that's a signature.
But I think that's a separate argument than what was initially argued below to the district court of whether or not that was just somebody, you know, scribbling with their pen to try to make sure it was working versus an actual signature.
Yeah. Well, that's the point that we were trying to raise at summary judgment, is that there was never an individual who came forward with an affidavit or a deposition testimony or anything who said this is a signature.
Where is that required under current case law and statutes?
First of all, you've got statute 406A and 406B and 406.7, which talk about burdens and prima facie burdens, and that you have to prove due execution. Then you got 524.2-2-502, which talks about how you duly execute. They have to be read together. You have the burden of proving due execution. Due execution requires a second witness and a second signature. If you can't come forward with sworn testimony about a second witness, you can't prove due execution. I liken this to a situation in which, let's say you've got a commercial contracts case that goes to summary judgment. And there are five issues that are identified as potential fact issues. And the judge at summary judgment denies the fact issues because 1, 2, 3, and 4 are issues for trial and ignores number 5, even though it's an essential element. And that's what we have here.
Court's order denying summary judgment, to take you back to the reviewability issue, the district court just ordered that the motion for summary judgment was denied, didn't say, I order that these are the only issues for trial.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So
but
I don't know how, you know, now that you've had a trial on the merits, you can still look back to the order denying summary judgment and say that's an order affecting the judgment.
Okay. Well,
I mean, you may have looked at the guidance and decided how to present your case based on the way that summary judgment order was, you know, denied, but the court certainly didn't say these are the only things the court will consider at trial, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. But I would say as a matter of practice, that's how civil litigation goes. As you go to summary judgment, these are the issues. These are the ones we're going to end up trying. You don't bring 100% of your issues at summary judgment. You bring the ones that you think you're going to be successful at.
Right, but I mean, the rule says the order has to affect the judgment. So you make a trial strategy decision, which may have been a great decision to present your case in a certain way. That's not an order affecting the judgment. That's you responding to the summary judgment order and deciding how to present your case, right?
Yeah, I would concede that, Your Honor. I would concede that it's a matter of strategy and tactics based on the earlier decisions. And I think that that's where the law of the case standard comes from, both at the appellate court and at the trial court level.
So, go ahead.
Let's talk about what you need for a will.
Yes.
Okay. It has to be in writing?
Yes.
This was, right?
Yep.
It has to be signed by the testator, which it was, correct?
We acknowledge that there was one signature signed by him that was notarized, yes.
Okay, and must be witnessed by two people.
Yes.
Then you can see that at least one signed, the notary.
Yes.
And at trial, it was found that a second one signed.
Yes.
That was a finding, right?
That was a finding of fact, yes.
Okay. And you must intend for it to be a will, which...
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So the only question is, was there a second witness? And that's the whole issue for you, isn't it?
Now? Yes. Yes.
Okay. So it comes down to whether the court abused its discretion, true, in making that decision about whether there was a second witness. Isn't that the essence of the case?
Yeah. Well, I'd need to go back and review whether it's clearly erroneous or abuse of discretion, but I agree that the standard is what the standard is.
But that's the one issue in this case is whether there was a second witness or not.
Yes.
But the finding was that there was.
Yes.
So that's the only thing you're asking us to really review, right?
Well, there's the subsidiary issue of whether or not the court had properly included issues related to issues that weren't tried. But yes, the primary issue is whether or not it was a valid decision to find that there was a second witness and that the will was validly executed in front of the second witness.
So explain to me how the finding was wrong of the second witness.
That's very clearly wrong on multiple levels. One, there was no evidence presented at trial of a second witness, and the judge's findings, before finding that it was validly executed in front of a second witness, made specific findings outlining the lack of evidence, saying nobody presented any of this evidence. And so if you're gonna come in and say, I don't have any evidence of a second witness, but I'm gonna find there was a second witness, that's clearly not supported by the record.
But outlining-
There was writing on the will.
There was writing on the will.
And the court found that it was a signature.
Yes.
And there's a date as well next to that signature.
And there's a date as well. And the judge admitted that there was no, or the judge made a specific finding, there was no evidence, and I just
right,
read
right. from it. Yeah. But the fact that that evidence is not there doesn't preclude a finding by the district court that it still is a second witness here. And we also look at the proximity of the date. This is... That's dated the day after the testator had signed the will and the notary.
Yep.
So it's very close in proximity in terms of time.
It is very close in proximity.
It's the next day. I think that your argument below was it's just a scribble. It's not a signature.
Yeah, and nobody's been able to find another signature that matches. We've had multiple deposits.
How does that preclude a finding by the district court that it still is a signature, especially when you have a date with the same writing right after, which seems to indicate that it's not just a scribble? Why would you have a date without a signature?
That's the question. We don't know.
Well,
we don't know.
Even if you have to show that that the district court's finding is clearly erroneous.
Yes.
Even if the record could have supported a separate finding, your burden now is to show that the finding by the district court that this, you know, marking here is and the date right next to it under the, you know, right next to the word witness and under the notary's date is in fact not a signature that is dated to show that somebody, we don't know who it is, that's very clear, but somebody signed it as a witness.
Yep. Well, we have two issues there. First of all, Your Honor, there was no evidence produced by the proponent of the will that it was a signature. So that's number one. Number two,
Is that required?
Yes, because they have to prove due execution. They have to prove that there was a second witness that was executed.
Let me rephrase that.
Okay.
Is it required other than being able to look at this at the signature itself?
Yes.
and the document?
Hands down, because
okay.
And you can
under
see that,
what under what case law? I'm can you
there's
or statute that requires that?
You can look at the two statutes side by side for a will. Basic will execution and self-authenticating wills. You can rely.
Self-authenticating wills doesn't apply here.
That's the point. It doesn't apply. You can rely on the signature when it is a self-authenticating will. This came up in another case that I actually just briefed. You have an overarching general theory in Minnesota of, let's say, giving effect to general propositions. General propositions give way to specific propositions, right? The legislature has said, look, we have a will statute. We want to avoid these types of issues. If you want to avoid these types of issues and questioning whether or not a signature is a signature and whether it's duly executed, you have to comply with the self-authenticating will statute.
The due execution statute, 524.3406A, only requires the testimony of at least one of the attesting witnesses, if within the state and competent and able to testify.
Yep.
And we had the testimony of one of the attesting witnesses in this case. The notary testified. So, why doesn't that? I mean, where is it required that the second witness, if you don't know their identity and you can't tell what their signature says, needs to testify? What's your authority?
My red light's blinking. May I answer? Yep.
Yes, you may.
Okay. We've got multiple authorities that were cited. We've got In re Larson. We've got the case from Montana. And we have the issue that that's a procedural question about who has to show up and testify, not about the content of their testimony. If you want to prove due execution and you have one witness who is a testator who signed the will and you know them and you can call them, you have to call them. You can't ignore that testifying witness. That is a procedural burden of proof level of who needs to come and be present and be able to be cross-examined. But it doesn't talk about the content of their testimony. And that's where we get into In re Larson, and then we get into the Montana case that I cited that's persuasive authority.
You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you,
Counsel. Counsel for respondent, 5 minutes will be set aside for counsel for Homeward Bound, Inc.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is George Serdar. I'm here representing respondent Homeward Bound, Inc. May it please the court and counsel. The only issue I would like to speak to this morning is the matter of the appeal from the denial of the motion for summary judgment. As the court noted earlier, an appeal from an order denying summary judgment is not appealable to this court. It runs afoul of the concept of scope of review. If the appellant is correct, if there was a denial of summary judgment and the same issues go to trial, the Court of Appeals would be required to review a set of facts that was before the district court on the summary judgment motion and the same set of facts that were before the court at the trial. That's clearly illogical and not consistent with the rules. The rules of appellate procedure do not include an order denying summary judgment, nor, as the court pointed out earlier, is the final ruling of the court in the order probating the will. The order denying the motion for summary judgment does not affect the order probating the will. Therefore, Your Honors, we believe that the district court was correct. We do not think that the appeal from the order denying summary judgment is appropriate and should be disregarded by this court. Does the court have any questions on that point? That's all I have for the court, and I'll yield the remainder of my time to Mr. Schenkenberg, who represents Union Gospel Mission. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court, my name is Phil Schenkenberg. I represent Union Gospel Mission. We respectfully request that the court affirm the well-reasoned decision of the district court to direct that Mr. Abrahamson's will be probated. I'm just going to jump in and address some of the issues that have been previously raised by the panel. I think Judge Smith is right. We've got agreement that there's a will in writing. It's a three-page will. That's a decision that was very clearly made and explained by the court. Mr. Abrahamson very clearly identified his assets, disposed of them to identified charities, and directed that his daughter, under no circumstances, should break the will. This question really comes down to whether or not we need eyewitness testimony about a second witness in a probate case like this, where you're trying to validate and show due execution of a will that's not self-authenticated. And I use that phrase, eyewitness testimony, because I believe counsel for Ms. Stark is using the phrase no evidence to mean no eyewitness testimony. And there's a difference between eyewitness testimony and other types of evidence. As Judge Eady noted, 2-406 requires that one witness be present and testify if available in the state and competent. And even if that's not the case, it goes on to say other evidence of due execution may be received, and the Minnesota Statute 525-242 also addresses secondary evidence and the availability of that. And so there isn't anything in the statute that requires eyewitness testimony of or about a second witness. And so what we have is circumstantial evidence. And the standard of review, as noted by Judge Reyes, requires deference to the finder of fact. And when we talk about circumstantial evidence, the question is, what's the alternative story, right? What other inference could this have led to? And was that other inference so overwhelming that the district court is deemed to have gotten it wrong? And we have a signature that an expert says was consistent with a handwritten signature. Nobody has testified, including the expert, this was the same handwriting as the first witness or the decedent. It's under the word witness, it's next to a date. There's all sorts of things that lead to the inference that this was a signature. And the district court also relied on testimony from Mr. Clausen and said, the district court said, I've evaluated Mr. Clausen's testimony and I'm convinced that on the third, the decedent was intentional about getting this document witnessed. He knew he needed a second witness, and I am going to decide that he went out the next day and got one. That's what the evidence points to. We could have a different case. Let's assume we have a different page three of this will. We have the signature of the decedent, we have the signature of the first witness, and we have nothing under the second witness. And at the bottom of the page, we have handwritten the words, eggs, milk, butter, flour. Okay, we have a writing on that page. I think we would all agree that in that case, the inference suggested by the writing on that page is not that those markings were made with an intent to witness a will. The inference is somebody was using that to make a grocery list or identify the ingredients in pound cake. But we don't have that. We've got facts that all point to one thing. And in Minnesota, there is no there's no prohibition on using circumstantial evidence to create this kind of finding of fact.
What are we to make of the argument that the witness had to be competent? How do we evaluate competency when we don't even know who the witness is, if they exist at all?
You defer to the district court, Your Honor, to make findings of fact and determine whether or not the inferences that are drawn by the evidence received support a prima facie case of due execution, which is a question of fact. And the fact that he went out to a UPS store where he was a regular customer to get the first witness, the conduct during that day on December 3rd that was described by Mr. Clausen, the testimony about the signature, there was no testimony by the expert that would have suggested that this was made by somebody who wasn't competent.
Are you talking about the competence of the testator? Is that what you're referring to? Or the witness, the unknown, just to clarify, you're talking about or the notary? Who are you speaking about?
What I was trying to suggest, Your Honor, is the facts that the district court had before it lead to an inference that the testator went out and got a second signature by somebody who was over 18 and competent.
You're referring to the unknown witness?
Yeah.
But does the due execution statute even require that second person as a floor be competent? I mean, as I read it, it looks to me like it may only require the person who actually testifies, which would have been the notary, right? Or do you read it to require all witnesses? Because the 524.3502 just says signed by at least two individuals, each of whom signed within a reasonable time after witnessing, and doesn't refer to their competence there.
You are correct that that doesn't refer to the, you use the word competent.
So, arguably, you could have an incompetent second witness sign under the law?
I'm not prepared to answer that question.
But we don't need to reach that because the legislature hasn't spoken on it, in your view.
I suppose that's correct. I apologize. I would hate to suggest that somebody can intentionally witness a document without being competent, without having looked at that.
I wasn't asking you to suggest that question. I was suggesting it, but I appreciate the response.
The inference either has to be that the person who made that signature was either competent or not competent. And I would submit to you that if the district court decides that the better inference is that that person was competent, there's no reason for this court to retry that issue and come to a different conclusion.
Who has the burden of proof on that?
Well, the
proponent... Or is there a need for a burden of proof on that?
The proponent of the will simply has to make a prima facie case of due execution, which says in writing, signed by the testator and signed by two witnesses.
Right, which appears to be met here.
It is certainly met here.
But who would have the burden of proving that the second witness was not competent then?
The burden would then shift to the opponent to prove, to disprove due execution or to prove undue influence, lack of capacity, et cetera. That's a burden shifting.
There were no other witnesses in this case, were there?
Ms. Stark put up no witnesses to prove undue influence or lack of capacity or lack of due execution.
Speaking of witnesses, go ahead.
Because I am a little troubled by the scribbling on the will. And that's why I asked the question, because the issue was whether there was a second witness or not. So that's why I asked the question.
So my question is, doesn't it seem a little troubling that the district court listed out all the evidence that was missing? Doesn't that seem to favor that the district court, in fact, did clearly err because there's so little there to support its decision?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. That is just good work by the district court. The district court was very even-handed, very thorough, and very thoughtful. Let me just suggest that if what we're talking about here, again, is whether or not circumstantial evidence is enough to prove that a second witness signed the document. And there's a little bit of briefing about circumstantial evidence, but let me point you to a different line of cases than what was briefed. And they're probate cases. One of the challenges to a will or a trust is undue influence, that the person making the testamentary document was pressured into doing something that they didn't want it to. There's a case decided by this court just last month, In Re Trust of Morin, M-O-R-I-N, and it is A23-0661. It's non-precedential, but it deals with undue influence. And in that case, this court affirmed a district court's finding that there was undue influence in the creation of the trust. And for 100 years, undue influence has been proved in Minnesota by circumstantial evidence, because it's unrealistic to expect that the testator, who's now passed away, would give live testimony about being influenced, and the person doing the influencing is probably not going to be trusted anyway. So we have this test that relies on circumstantial evidence, and when you prove undue influence, you have to do it to a clear and convincing standard. And so if the probate code and the trust code rely on circumstantial evidence to prove undue influence to a clear and convincing standard, and is affirmed in a case like In re Morin, it's certainly good enough to prove something as simple as a prima facie case that a second person signed a document. So circumstantial evidence is not disfavored. It's in many cases better than eyewitness testimony, and there's no distinction in the trust code or the probate code that would tell this court that circumstantial evidence is not enough for this purpose. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for appellant, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. The case that my learned counsel, opposing counsel, just mentioned that was recently decided by this court dealt with circumstantial evidence by two attorneys and four doctors, all providing evidence regarding competency of a person. None of that's here. The two cases that were cited in their responsive brief were both workers' compensation cases. One relied on three witnesses, two of which were experts. The other one relied on five witnesses, all to find a single factual determination that the person in question was intoxicated.
But at bottom, I mean, even taking your point, aren't you asking us then to step into the shoes of the district court and reweigh the evidence and say, look at all this evidence that the district court cited, or lack of evidence about who the identity of the second witness was, and that wasn't enough. But, on our standard review, are we really allowed to do that if the bare minimum requirements for due execution as a matter of law were met here?
Yes. Yes, because I'm not asking you to weigh evidence. I'm asking you to show or to recognize there was no evidence. The only evidence, and the judge repeatedly says this, the only evidence we have is the signature itself.
Isn't that all that's required?
No, not at all. And to go to Judge Edie's question earlier, that dovetails with, I'm sorry, I went back to the paper to find some information. There is a requirement for competency of witnesses, and you cannot have someone who proves up a will without proving up the competency of the witness. Witness competency can be found in Minnesota Statute 595.02.
Well, that's for a testifying witness, right? I mean, are you saying that there's a statute that applies to probate that
Yes.
says that the second witness needs to be proven competent in a contested probate proceeding?
What I have, and I wasn't able to find it in the limited time during the questioning, and I know it exists, is there is a probate statute that says the people who are competent to bear witness, 595.02, are the ones who are competent to witness a will.
Well, what about your counterpart's kind of anticipation of that argument, which was after the prima facie requirements of due execution were met, the burden then shifted to you and your client to produce some evidence that the second witness was then incompetent?
How can I do that, Your Honor? And this is one of the things that came up in the motion for a directed verdict or a motion as a matter of law. If they have not provided any evidence and nobody can locate them, how can you burden shift to the person when there's a lack of evidence to begin with?
But
that's
counsel,
fundamentally unfair.
Counsel, when I'm looking at it, I think Judge Eda is right that under Minnesota Statute 524-3-502, in terms of the requirements for a will, it says in writing, signed by a testator, and then says signed by at least two individuals, each of whom signed within a reasonable time after witnessing either signing of the will, et cetera, et cetera. it says nothing about the witnesses being competent.
That's in a different statute, Your Honor, and it's cited somewhere in either my brief or in the district court paper.
And under Minnesota statute section 524.3-406A, it talks about, it does talk about competence there, but only talks about that in context, again, to Judge Eade's point, of the testimony of at least one of the attesting witnesses, if within the state competent and able to testify, is required. So we don't even need, we only need testimony for one person.
Right? Again, that goes back to the argument I made in my initial argument, that only talks about the procedure of who has to come and testify, not about the content of their testimony, and not about meeting the prima facie or the ultimate burden of persuasion.
I mean, I take your fairness point, but the problem that I have with that is that isn't it also unfair to the party who's seeking to probate the will? They don't know who the second signature was either. And so once the burden shifts to you to show that, you know, there was not a competent second witness, then if the burden is shifted, why should they be faulted when they don't know who that person is either? I'm sure they would have liked to have called the second witness.
Yeah. And let's take that to the next logical step. What if both signature lines are illegible? If both signature lines are, if it's true,
need due execution, right? Because you wouldn't be able to have the bare minimum for due execution, which is one competent witness at the least to come in and testify. But that existed in this case.
But the one competent witness in this case also wasn't an attesting witness. He was I believe it was called the subscribing witness. He disavowed any knowledge of what the document was. He said he doesn't witness wills. I would not have witnessed the will. And the judge even made a comment in his order that contradicted the transcript by saying, the judge specifically asked Mr. Clausen, if Roger Abramson had asked you to witness the will, would you have done so? No, I don't witness wills. I don't care what the document is. I don't care how many pages it is. I don't want to remember how many pages it is.
But that still ultimately is up to the finder of fact for the district court. The district court can discredit that testimony and just say, I understand what he said, but I have a document in front of me with his signature, with his date, which he acknowledges is his signature and his date. And to get back to the other point of the other witness, I mean, the only person that may know the identity of the second witness is a decedent. So, you know, to in terms of the whole fairness issue, it seems that the statute takes into account that nobody may actually know who that person is or much less how to find them. So let's just, under the statute, we're only going to require at least one of the witnesses to testify.
And I agree with that proposition. However, when that eventuality is triggered, all of the statutes that have been cited by the respondent come into play with other competent evidence. The court can rely on its decision on other competent evidence.
And the district court found that the agreement itself and the testimony, that the agreement itself basically speaks for itself in terms of being able to look at it.
Yeah, so what it did was it said, the district court said, this is not a self-authenticating document. It's not entitled to any of the presumptions of a self-authenticating document, including that it was duly executed. But looking at the document itself, I'm going to find that it was duly executed. I mean, if that's not clear error, that's not an abuse of discretion, that's not cause for overturning it right there, I don't know what is. I mean, if you specifically say the document doesn't comply with the requirements for me to look at this document and find it's facially valid because it doesn't comply with the statute for self-authentication, but I'm going to look at the document and say, yes, it was duly executed.
We aren't talking about a self-executing will. We're talking about what the requirements of the statute are for proving a will.
Exactly.
And those were met here. Those were met because there was a competent witness. It was a will. The only question, again, is whether the trial court erred in determining that the second witness was second signature was a signature. That's to me the only issue here.
Well, and
we agreed at the beginning.
Well, and I would say there's the other question is also whether or not that second witness was competent, whether it was made on December 13th.
But that's a requirement of the of proof for admitting the will under the statute.
Well, I'm sorry, I don't understand the question that you just phrased.
The burden for admitting a will.
Yes.
One witness testifying that they were a witness to the will and the will itself and two witnesses.
Yes.
It doesn't say anything else.
I understand that, Your Honor, but...
So I'm trying to see where the district court was wrong.
If that single witness, and again, this goes back to Larson, doesn't say there was a second witness to the will, there wasn't a second individual, how can a court find that there is a second witness to the will? I mean, it's no different than if it was blank. There's no different. What if the date next to the second signature wasn't there? I mean, there's this to allow this will to be probated essentially eviscerates the burden standard, all of that. Because yes, you only have to have one competent witness under 406A. Yes, they bear the burden. But the issue is that there was no circumstantial, no direct evidence of a second witness aside from the signature. And I think as a matter of law, that's insufficient.
Well, but I've drafted hundreds
yeah.
of wills. Two witnesses, a lot of times they die.
Yes.
They can't testify.
Yes.
The other people go off into California or wherever,
yes.
and you've got one witness.
Yes.
Under your scenario, it would be impossible to ever prove the second witness.
That's not true at all, Your Honor, and you can look
unless
at parole.
Unless you're self-executing, but here we're not.
No, I don't agree with that at all, Your Honor. All you have to do is look at Peralt, and Peralt says, okay. and Peralt is cited by me, responded to by the respondents, and then again analyzed in my reply. In that case, you, John Smith, attorney, testifies about drafting, about witnessing it. You don't have that person.
I'd be dead by then.
Well, let's hope not, Your Honor.
Yeah, well, I hope not, too. That'd be bad for me. But
yeah. On that happy note, I think we can...
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Thank you all, counsel, for your briefing and your arguments. We'll be issuing an opinion within the 90-day statutory time frame. Thank you all.
Thank you.